Good evening. Welcome behind the news for, April 19, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got only one item planned for tonight, three parts of a presentation by the economist Nicholas Stern, which was part of a panel discussion at Columbia University, which was held last Wednesday, April 11th. And on the economics of global warming or climate change. Take your pick of terminology. Nicholas Stern is a former chief economist of the World Bank, and last fall the British government published a 700-page review of the economics of climate change that he did or supervised, which has become known as the Stern Review. It's in many ways very orthodox and tepid in its economics and its recommendations, but I think Stern does a very excellent job of laying out the issues and helps us think clearly about what needs to be done. And I think he's also to be commended for introducing into elite discourse the idea that the cost of doing nothing about global warming is much, much greater than the cost of doing something, which would be a lesson for people in the Bush administration and such like who think that it's too expensive to do something about climate change. Not doing anything is a lot more expensive. So let's listen to the first part. I've broken this into three parts, about 45 minutes altogether. Let's listen to the first part of the presentation by Nicholas Stern.
I thought I'd start by giving those of you a chance to leave early who want to by describing all the reasons, and I think they're basically three, for not bothering about climate change. And the first one is that the science is all rubbish. I think was it Senator Inhofer that described it as the biggest hoax perpetrated on mankind? Well, I think if you look at the... I'm not a scientist. We were consumers of the science on this. It's amazing how many economists become or appear to become expert scientists as soon as they get anywhere near this story. But we were consumers of the science. We consumed the science that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has recently summarized. We tried to take the best possible advice that we could, including the Hadley Center in the UK, Klaus Lackner and others here in Colombia. We took the best advice we could, but essentially we took the science as it came. And that has been summarized very clearly and strongly in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report in February, early February of this year, and then last week. That the first one was about the relationship between emissions and temperature, and then this week exploring, about a week ago, exploring in much more detail some of the impacts associated with those temperature increases. So I think if you look at the overall body of science, then essentially to deny the science or describe it as a hoax is completely untenable and or absurd. So one way is to deny the science. The second is to say that the human species is quite incredibly adaptable, and whatever comes its way, it'll deal with. I think given what we now know about the magnitudes or the possible magnitudes, and this is all about risks, of course, the possible magnitudes of the changes, that has to be regarded as reckless. We could, if we go on as business as usual, see, and I'll give a little detail on this, see by the end of this century emissions that could be close to double where they are now. That would take us, according to the latest science, as summarised in the IPCC report or in the book edited by Schellenhuber, Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change, that would take us to a larger than 50% probability of being above 5 degrees centigrade higher than we were at pre-industrial times. That is absolutely enormous change. In the last ice age, 10, 12,000 years ago, we were 5 degrees centigrade below where we are now. At that time, much of northern Europe and Canada would have been under a mile of ice. These kinds of temperature changes are earth-transforming. Another 5 degrees centigrade or more would be earth-transforming. It would change the physical geography of the world, change the human geography of the world, and just as the Ice Age pushed people down towards the equator, this kind of change would push people away from the equator in a very strong way, and the human species is very bad at reacting and dealing with those kinds of population movements. So I think to say that we can react to whatever comes our way, given what we now know about the risks that we face, has to be regarded as reckless. So deny the science and be absurd. Assume that we can react to whatever comes our way, adapt to whatever comes our way. That, I think, now has to be regarded as reckless relative to the kinds of risks that we face. The third thing to do is to say that the future is unimportant. That it's in the future. You know, we live in the present. We sort things out now. We deal with the problems of today. These are problems far into the future. And we put a fairly low weight on the future. In terms of the language that economists use, it's possible that some of you here are not economists. I'll try to make whatever I say accessible to those who are not economists. I do understand that not everybody is perfect. And but in the nerdy language of economics, we talk about pure time discounting. Now, if you have a pure time discount rate of 2% that you regard next year as of interest or weight, if you like, 2% lower than now, and you run that forward, you get the kind of phenomenon I describe. You would, the 2% pure time discount rate, somebody born in 1975 would have twice the ethical weight of somebody born in 2010. That is essentially discrimination by date of birth. Nothing to do with income levels. That comes in elsewhere. That's very important. Simply, this has to do with the future being in the future. Now, that is something that seems, I think, to most people, or should seem to most people, ethically very strange. Why would you have a weight of a half of somebody born in 2010 relative to somebody born in 1975? That, I think, most people regard as ethically unacceptable. So those three ways. You can deny the science. You can say that we can adapt to whatever comes our way, or you can say the future is unimportant. In turn, I think absurd, reckless, and ethically untenable. But if you accept any of those arguments, you think they're overwhelming, now is the time to leave, because what I'm going to do is to try to describe how we should look at this problem if we don't follow one of those routes. And of course, I'll give a fair bit more detail on the kind of arguments that I have just put. Now, let's switch to the story of economics and how the economics follows from the science. The basic science of all this shapes the economics. The basic science says that it doesn't matter where your emission of greenhouse gases comes from, it has the same effect. It doesn't matter if it comes from Australia or the United States or China or India or the UK, it has the same effect. So this means that we have a global problem. Many of these effects are very long-term because this is a flow-stop problem. It's the stock of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that stops the energy, the infrared energy, from escaping, and that is what makes the Earth warmer than it would otherwise be. So it's a stock that causes the problem, and what we can control or try to control each year is a flow, the flow of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So this is a flow-stop problem, and that makes it quite a long-term story, because the emissions that we make today have their effect, which are quite small relative to the overall stock, build up over time and have their effects far into the future, as well as in the nearer term. But what you've got then is a flow-stop process, which gives quite long lags in the system, quite long lags of our actions now relative to their consequences. There are other lags too, of course, between the stocks building up and the effect coming through in higher temperature. So this is a long-term issue. It's global and it's long-term, and there's lots of risk and uncertainty in the system. There's risk and uncertainty associated with the connection between the economy and the amount of greenhouse gases. We don't know exactly that relationship between the economy and the amount of greenhouse gases emitted. You've got the uncertainties about the way the flow stop process actually develops and the absorptive capacity of the world in relation to carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. You've got the risks or the uncertainties associated with the relationship between temperature and effect, physical effect. You've got the risks and uncertainties associated with the relationship between the physical effect and the economic and social effects. There are lots of uncertainties and risks in the system. I'll mostly speak of risk and uncertainty interchangeably. At one or two points, I'll draw the distinction, which we often do in economics, where risk is where you have some idea of the probabilities and uncertainty is where you don't. But I'll come back to that, I'll touch on it. But mostly I'll use that language interchangeably. So what we've got here is a problem which immediately from the science is global, long-term, and full of risk and uncertainty. So we have to use the economic tools that we have that are capable of dealing with these kinds of problems. So that's the very simple but basic and fundamental way in which the science shapes the economics. Now, we normally talk in this context of externalities, that an externality occurs where some action of mine affects the production or consumption possibilities of other people. That's an externality. So the climate change is an externality, but it's different from most of the externalities we deal with because of the global aspects of the story, the long-term aspects of the story, and the great deal of risk and uncertainty. Compare it, for example, with congestion in London, where we have a price mechanism to deal with this externality, which is called the congestion charge. The congestion that occurs in London, you can recognise immediately. It's the car and the other cars in front of you. You can see what's doing it, and it happens quickly. But with these long-term effects, recognising for people to recognise how it happens is a much more complicated process that involves thinking and understanding and evidence. You don't experience the congestion in the immediate sense that you experience. You don't experience the damage in the immediate sense that you experience the congestion if you're talking about traffic. So this is very different from that kind of externality, and that difference comes directly from the science in terms of global, long-term, and lots of risk. That then tells us that we face a very different kind of problem than the externalities that we usually deal with. The basic economic theory of externalities is indeed something that's very valuable in connection with this problem, but its application is much more difficult than it is normally in economics. What do we need to bring to bear to understand the story? Economics of risk, clearly, from what I've already said. Ethics have to be at the centre because this is about the relationship between this generation and future generations who are not directly represented in any marketplace, and it's an issue that requires international action. So these are the kinds of economics that we have to bring to bear, and it follows immediately from the structure of the problem as derived from the science. Now, how do these effects actually work? Well, one way or the other, they work through water, mostly through water. There are direct effects through heat stress. In 2003, many thousands of people died in Europe as a result of the very hot summer. Those of you who've lived and worked in India will know that the Indo-Gangetic Plain in April and May can get up to temperatures around 40 degrees centigrade, and another 5 or 10 degrees centigrade on top of that, because it will be much more on land than it is on average, would actually give you very severe heat stress and risk the lives of hundreds of millions of people. But mostly these effects work through water in some shape or form. Storms, floods, droughts, sea level rise, mostly through water. That's why the language of climate change is much better than the language of global warming. In the words of President Putin, global warming, when you're in Moscow in February, sounds like a good idea. But climate change is something different. You can have a similar amount of rainfall, but you can get much more of the rainfall in much fewer the days, leading to floods and then droughts in other parts of the year. That's climate change, and it wouldn't actually be directly observable simply from temperature or aggregate rainfall. So the way in which these effects work is extremely important to the whole story. And there are, of course, many dimensions to this. I've described already these kinds of effects that operate mainly through water. There'd be great threats to species at 3 degrees centigrade increase relative to pre-industrial times. You're talking about 20 to 50% of the species being likely to be extinct. Those are very big changes, and they're multidimensional. They occur in all kinds of ways. And simply to try and capture them, as many of us do, and including us in some ways, in terms of simple effects on consumption, is actually a bit crude. It affects, as it were, people's lives right across the board, and it's important to try to pick that up. If not, if you can't do it formally, at least informally. So these are the kinds of effects that can happen. I've already emphasised that 5 degrees centigrade is an enormous change, and that we risk, if we go on as business as usual, temperatures above 5 degrees centigrade in excess of pre-industrial times sometime next century. Now, what are the probabilities of going there? We measure the concentrations in terms of parts per million of CO2 equivalent. And a red bar there is a 90% confidence interval that says you've got 5% probability of being off the bottom end in terms of temperature and a 5% probability of being off the top end in terms of temperature. Now, if you stabilise at 550 parts per million of CO2 equivalent, then you would see a 50-50 chance, roughly, of being above or below 3 degrees centigrade. Now, 3 degrees centigrade is a big increase. The scientists who've looked at this have often spoken about dangerous climate change corresponding to temperature increases above 2 degrees centigrade relative to pre-industrial times. 3 degrees centigrade is a big increase, but you can see if we stabilised at 550 parts per million, there'd be a real possibility of temperature increases above 4 degrees centigrade eventually, and in some models, and that's what the dotted lines represent, in some models, even a significant possibility of being above 5 degrees centigrade. So 550 parts per million would be a risky place to be. Where are we now? We're around 430 parts per million, and we're adding 2.5 parts per million a year. So in 8 years or so, we'll be at 450. 450 gives you roughly 50-50 chance of being above or below a 2 degrees centigrade increase relative to pre-industrial times. If we went on under business as usual, because that 2.5 parts per million is increasing, the amount we add each year, if we went on not doing very much for 30 years or so, 30 or 35 years, we'd probably be at 550 parts per million. So we are close to already ranges which are going to be very difficult to cope with and will require a significant amount of adaptation. We argue in the review, and I'll give a little more detail in just a minute, that we could stabilise below 550 parts per million at a cost of around 1% per annum of GDP. And we argue that that is a reasonable price to pay for the risks which would be avoided by stabilising below 550 parts per million. We're already very close to 450, as I argued, and we take from this basic argument of risk in a very simple sort of aggregate perspective, we argue in the review that we should be stabilising somewhere between 450 and 550 parts per million. The bottom end of the range, because we're nearly there already, the top end of the range, because I think that is already pushing most people's view of what a risky place to be should be. Now, that's a very important conclusion, that we should be stabilising somewhere between 450 and 550 parts per million, because most of what follows in terms of the cost analysis, the various policy mechanisms for getting there, come fairly quickly from that objective. But I do think that most people, thinking through the descriptions of the kinds of effects that we now see, for example, in the IPCC's reports and elsewhere, that to aim above 550 parts per million would be very risky and dangerous. So that basically gives you the kind of target areas we talked about, and I'll be explaining how we get to the costs of stabilising there and what kinds of policy mechanisms could be used to stabilise us in that range. We have an open mind as where we should be, between 450 and 550 parts per million. Many of my friends argue strongly, and I see what they mean, that 550 is a too dangerous place to be, and we should be stabilising below that. In the report, we left that open. Now, what if you let it all go as business as usual? We're adding 2.5 parts per million. That 2.5 parts per million every year that we're adding is rising. Probably over a century, it would average around 4. So over a century of business as usual, we'd be adding around 400 parts per million. That would take us from the 430 where we are now, well over 800. It'd drop us off the bottom end of this graph. And we'd be talking about, as I said a few minutes ago, a probability better or bigger than a half of temperature increases eventually above 5 degrees centigrade. And that would absolutely be Earth transforming. So that's the basic storyline. Now, economists like to build models and add things up. So we follow suit, but we regard this kind of model building exercise as a supplementary argument to the argument I just gave about risk. Nevertheless, it's a useful supplementary argument and allows us to investigate the mechanics and the logic of some parts of the story. Now, I haven't got time to go into the details. I'll take about 5 minutes or so on the details. Those of you who don't like your economic modelling can relax for about 5 minutes while I work myself through this. But there are some people here who do take it seriously. I take it seriously, but as I said, as a supplementary argument to the kinds of arguments I just put about risk and stabilising between 450 and 550.
And the voice of Nicholas Stern, I think he's Sir Nicholas Stern now, former chief economist of the World Bank and lead author of a massive 700-page review of the economics of climate change published by the British government last October. That's from a presentation at Columbia University organized by the Committee on Global Thought, a little think tank up there. And we will be back, take a station break, and then we'll listen to more Nicholas Stern. And we're back. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to hear more from Nicholas Stern. That was an excerpt from Bach's Partita No. 1 for keyboard, performed by Glenn Gould. That's the first movement, the prelude. And let's return to part two of the presentation by Nicholas Stern, the economist, former chief economist of the World Bank, in a program at Columbia University organized by the Committee on Global Thought. That came up a little over a week ago. I've omitted this portion of Stern's presentation where he reviews some of the economics involved in detailed economics involved in his analysis, but it boils down to this. What he estimates we could spend about 1% of GDP, 1% of the total value of goods and services produced globally, and if we do that, we can avoid most of the worst consequences of climate change. The worst consequences of climate change would have an economic effect, he estimates, of anywhere from 5 to 20% of GDP. Sickness, disease, flooding, crop failures, all those things would have a very substantial negative economic effect. So he is arguing, which is not an argument typically heard in elite economic circles, that the cost of doing nothing is far greater than the cost of doing something. So that's the gist of the omitted portion, and let's go to part two of Nicholas Stern's presentation.
So we're left with the conclusion that the statement that the costs of action, around 1%, are a great deal less than the cost of inaction, 5% and above, is a pretty robust statement, that the economics of climate change point very strongly to serious and urgent action. I've spoken mostly about stocks, 450, 550, 650 parts per million. Now let's look at the flows. The flows are those, describe those paths of emissions over time, which could give you stabilisation at 550. The blue line is the emissions over time corresponding to business as usual. That goes on upwards. The yellow line corresponds to emissions which will stabilise around 550 parts per million. So you can see that if we are to stabilise around 550 parts per million, as I said, many people regard that as a risky place to be, we have to peak emissions as a world, have them peak within 15 or 20 years, and thereafter start to fall. And by 2050, we'd have to have emissions 30% below where we are now. Absolutely. So that would leave us in a position which, as I try to emphasise, 550 parts per million is still a risky place to be. But you can see that even to achieve that requires pretty strong action over the, really starting from now. Because if we are to have emissions absolutely peaking in 15 or 20 years, the decisions necessary to do that have to be decisions now. So that gives you the kind of path, that gives you a very clear indication of the sense of urgency here. If we go on, as I said before, with 30 or 40 years of not doing very much, we'd already be at 550 parts per million. And once you're at 550 parts per million, you're going to go on rising from that if you haven't taken any action. You're into still more dangerous territory. And of course, the nature of the flow stop problem means that once this stuff is in the atmosphere, it's very difficult to get it out. Obviously, if you could think of a massive vacuum cleaner that suck it all out of the atmosphere, you could relax a great deal, but you wouldn't want to bet the ranch on that coming into existence. If it does come into existence, I'm sure it will be as a result of scientific research in Colombia, but still, I wouldn't bet the ranch on that. Of course, if you want to stabilize below 550 parts per million, you have to peak earlier and reduce more strongly. Now, what does that say about targets for rich countries? Targets for the world, we said, have to be around 30% below, absolutely, where we are now by 2050. Now, of course, that involves very strong action because we all hope that the world economy will be 2, 3, 4 times as large by 2050 as it is now. We also hope, at least I hope you hope, that we'll see strong growth in the developing countries. 75% of the emission of the stock that's up there now comes from the rich countries. And it's the poor countries who will suffer earliest and most. There's a real inequity in this system. So given the responsibility for past emissions, given that it's the rich countries that will have better technologies to cope with the adjustment, given that they're richer and better capable of paying for the adjustment, many people would argue, certainly we did in the review, that the contribution of the rich countries to this reduction should be much higher than 30%. Now, targets in the UK have 60% reductions by 2050, France 75% reductions by 2050, California 80% reductions by 2050. Those start to be in the right sort of range to get you to 30% reductions overall by 2050, allowing for some growth in the emissions from developing countries. So as I said, stabilising between 450 and 550 gives you very strong policy targets. Strong policy targets for 2050 for the world, and then if you add the equity story to it, strong policy targets for emissions reductions in the rich countries. And that to achieve just 550 parts per million, which is still a risky place to be. So that's why it's important to focus on that argument of stabilising between 450 and 550. So that basically finishes the first part of what I have to say. The rest of what I have to say is about the policies that could do this for you. But basically, we're arguing that 1% of world GDP would be enough to do it for you. You'd have to have good policies. It's not true that any old policies will keep it below 1% of GDP. But reasonably sensible policies, I'll try to describe what those are, could keep you below 1% of GDP in terms of costs. That is not the kind of thing that stops growth. Now that's a very important argument. It's like a one-off 1% kick upwards in a price index. You do your energy in a bit more expensive way. Once you've made the transition, it doesn't go on getting any more expensive. Indeed, it could get cheaper the cleverer you get at doing this. Now a one-off 1% increase in your cost or price index is important. 1% of world GDP is significant. But it's not the kind of change that stops growth. What this tells you very clearly is that you can be green in this sense and grow. The anti-growth strategy is business as usual. Eventually, that will run into problems where growth is disrupted and it's very difficult to sort out the problems because of this flow stop process. You have to live with the stocks that you've generated in the past. So that's a very important conclusion. It means you can link growth and responsibility on the climate. It's also the case that these measures fit pretty well with energy security, and that's been a discussion which, as we all know, in the United States has been pretty strong, the close link between climate responsibility and energy efficiency. So that's telling us that there's no horse race between growth, climate responsibility, and energy security. Good policies can bring them together. Basically, there are three strands to policy here. One is to price for the externality. People should pay the cost of the damages they cause. Secondly is R&D, and third is related market failures and other behavioural changes. I'll explain what that means. Now, the first part of the story is the standard economics argument that you have a market failure if people don't pay for the cost of their actions. You normally pay for the labour embodied in what you buy, the raw materials, the capital embodied in what you buy. You should also pay the damage that you that you inflict on others associated with your emission of greenhouse gases. That's simply saying that markets fail unless prices reflect costs. So, and that's why we call this the biggest market failure the world has seen, because everybody is doing it and everybody suffers from responses from the implications, and those implications can be very large. So first, correct the market failure. You've got to have some sort of price for these externalities, prices for emissions of greenhouse gases. Now, if you were pure Chicago, you could stop the story there. You correct the market failure and you let the entrepreneurship and the competition sort it out. That's not a bad argument, but it's very far from the full argument. Why? Well, in this case, a number of reasons, but one of them is that no individual firm or consumer can be totally confident about the evolution of the government policies, international government policies over the indefinite future. You can't give, try as hard as you can, you should try hard, you can't give these very strong and clear signals that are required for people to assume that the market failure is corrected and corrected permanently. So you've got to go beyond that, and that's why we emphasise also the importance of investing in research and development. Now, there are related market failures which stop people making investments even though you've managed to correct the price for carbon and greenhouse gas emissions. People don't necessarily invest in buildings, insulating buildings, making them more carbon efficient, if they don't think that through tenancy markets they'll get the returns to their investment. These are the kinds of market failures which could inhibit the kinds of investments you would want to make, and that's why it's important in some areas to make regulations and use regulations and standards. Those will be a very important part of the story as well. I've already emphasised how this is consistent with other policy goals. Economists often emphasise sticks and carrots, and you ignore the sticks and carrots and incentives at your peril. Forget about that, you've got bad economics, everything goes wrong. But of course people change their behaviour not simply through market incentives, but also by making their own judgments about what's responsible. Now, most of us now recycle. For most of us there's no financial incentive to recycle. Why do we do it? Because we believe it's irresponsible not to. We would feel very bad if we just threw tin cans and bottles into the street. Now that's something that's changed actually over the last 30 or 40 years. It helps, of course, if governments and communities make it easier for you to recycle. But the basic responsibility of not spitting your chewing gum onto the pavement is something that we think about, and we don't do it because we think it's irresponsible to do it. At least you shouldn't do it. And these kinds of discussions about climate change will, I think, start to affect people's own behaviour in terms of their view of what's responsible. And that is part of policy. And we try to change people's behaviour in public policy all the time. Education is in large measure about that. So these are the kinds of things which I think economists should talk about much more, about how to change people's understandings of what responsible is. Now, you can use the language of changing preferences. People who say, I'm an economist, I've come along to change your preferences, might be viewed with some suspicion, and rightly so. But all the same, it's an issue that we really need to discuss much more than we do normally in economics. Carbon pricing. You can tax, that's one way of doing it, and we have high taxes on gasoline in much of Europe. And that is in part, not only of course, but in part to do with these kinds of externalities. You can do it through emissions trading, where you impose caps on firms, and if they want to go above their cap, they have to buy the right, and if they go below the cap, they can sell the permits. That's emissions trading. It's coming in, as we all know, northeastern United States, in a year or two, and it is something which has been in working in Europe for a couple of years. We've made our mistakes at the beginning. Don't make the mistakes that we made. We made the obvious mistakes of giving out too many permits, and surprise, surprise, the price of a permit was very low. You don't need Economics 101 to work that out. But we've learned from the mistakes, and we're tightening them up, and I think it's starting to move pretty strongly. And the price of a permit 3 or 4 years down the track in the forward market is 17 or 18 euros a tonne of CO2. So we're starting to get serious prices in those markets. Now, what I've argued, though, is that we have to approach this through a method which says, let's cap the emissions that we're trying to... let's limit the emissions which... we will allow in any year. So we start off with this quantity target, and we got there from this stabilisation at 450 to 550. And then we use the price mechanism, like emissions trading, to stable, to decentralise those markets and bring costs down. So the economics of risk gives you the quantitative target, but the economics of cost and flexibility tells you that you use the market mechanism to decentralise those fixed quantity targets that you have. And that, I think, is a good story. It doesn't, of course, and those of you who like to think in terms of social cost of carbon, it doesn't quite go that route. It goes the route of thinking about what stabilisation means and what that means for emissions, treating those as caps, and then using prices to decentralise the mechanisms for staying within those caps. You can check it against social cost of carbon. That is a useful check to make. But calculation of social cost of carbon is such a difficult thing to do and subject to so many uncertainties. We thought that this route was in any case the right one and gave us less, as it were, pressure, less emphasis on having to calculate something that was very difficult to calculate, like the social cost of carbon. The quantity targets are much easier to get to.
And that, again, Nicholas Stern, who is a former chief economist at the World Bank and author, lead author of a 700-page review of the economics of climate change, which was published last fall by the British government. And as I said at the top of the program, I don't certainly agree with a lot everything he has to say, but I think he does a very good job of laying it out lucidly and bringing up some of the issues, which we'll be revisiting as soon as next week when I'll bring on some folks who are contributors to the Nation magazine special issue on climate change, which will be out. Well, it'll be up on the web tomorrow, out to subscribers a day or two after that. I've got a piece in there, and we'll have some of the other contributors as well to talk about the issues of climate change, which is rather important. Let's take a musical break, and then we'll be back with the final portion of a talk by Nicholas Stern. And that an excerpt from the first movement of the sixth partita for keyboard by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Glenn Gould. And now let's turn to the conclusion of a presentation by Nicholas Stern, who is the lead author of the Stern Review on the Economics of Climate Change. This was recorded at Columbia University last Wednesday, April 11th, a program organized by Columbia's Committee on Global Thought. Nicholas Stern.
It is actually quite shocking that world R&D on energy has gone down by about a half in the last 25 years or so. The reasons for that we can discuss, but it's gone exactly in the wrong direction, and it should be pushed very strongly in the opposite direction over these next few years. It is starting to change over these last year or two, but we've got a long way to go to make up for the neglect of research on energy in the past. Let me say a few words about international action. I've emphasised right from the beginning that this is about international collective action. The UK is 2% of emissions. India, 3 or 4% of emissions. There are lots of countries making significant contributions, but fairly small percentages of the total. US, over 20% of emissions. China, well over 10% of emissions and moving up very rapidly. Could well overtake the US in terms of emissions in the next few years. But each country is a minority of the emissions. What we all have to do is find ways of working together. Now, how do you get people to work together? The first thing we look at in economics is the free rider problem or the prisoner's dilemma, which essentially says that each person has an incentive to hope that other people will take responsibility for this, and they will cheat or free ride by taking no responsibility. And that is a basic problem in all this, the free rider problem. How do you get people to come together? Well, the first thing you have to do is to try to get people to understand the problem, to gain a common understanding of the problem, and to realise that we all have to act together. That's not a trivial thing to do, but if we accept that it's a global problem, if we accept that we're all contributing to it, that is an important step along the way for all to all recognising the need for action. The second thing for mutual understanding is recognising what other people are doing. Now, when I'm in China, I spend quite a lot of time explaining to them what United States is doing about climate change. Because you hear United States didn't sign Kyoto, they're not interested, they deny the problem, and now they're asking us, who are not responsible for the vast majority of greenhouse gases up there, they're now asking us to help sort out the problem that they've created when they are doing nothing. So I try to explain patiently about California, about the Northeastern United States trading scheme, about the US investments in R&D, about the many US companies that are trying to take this issue seriously, about the many US cities that are trying to take this seriously, and they say, oh really, that's interesting. When I testified to Senator Bingaman's committee about a month ago on the Senate, the Senate Energy Committee, I spent a lot of time explaining what China is doing. China is reforesting, it's not deforesting. China, you can't sell an American car in China, it doesn't satisfy the emissions standards. You've got an $8,000 tax on an SUV in Beijing. China just introduced at the end of last year, end of November, beginning of December, an export tax on energy intensive industries. And the Chinese 11th five-year plan, which started last year, had a 20% reduction in the energy output ratio, energy per unit of output target, over 5 years. There are only two headline targets in that plan, 9% growth rate and the reduction of energy to output by 20%. And they're holding the leaders of the 1,000 biggest firms in China personally responsible for meeting the energy efficiency targets. And they do have ways of holding you personally responsible. So at the same time, the United States is the biggest emitter by a long way, and China is opening a coal-fired electricity plant every week. But if you're to reach some kind of mutual understanding of how to go forward, it's crucially important to understand what others are doing. So that's another part of the story of building international collective action. You're going to have it. Carbon emissions trading working on an international level if India and China are to be persuaded to make the changes. They need some contribution towards the cost. And that's why emissions trading is so important. And you're also going to need a sharing of R&D and actually demonstrate that the new ways of doing your energy actually work. My Indian friends, and I've worked longer in India than I have in China, they say, Nick, look, you keep going on about carbon capture and storage for coal, because most of 70-75% of India and China's electricity will be coal for the next 30 or 40 years. They say, you keep going on about carbon capture and storage for coal. I say, yes, it's important, because you're going to use coal, lots of people are going to use coal, and coal is the most polluting. So you've got to catch the stuff and stick it underground. They say, look, Nick, you've got my telephone number. Just as soon as that's working in the UK, you give me a call, I'll be right over and I'll have a look. And you can understand where they're coming from. So we have to demonstrate these things very clearly in Europe, in Australia, in the United States, and so on. I believe that we can do that, and I believe that that's moving very quickly, but we have the obligation to do that and then to share those technologies. That's the carbon capture and storage for coal, a crucial example, but there are other examples, of course, as well. Solar and biofuels and all those stories are extremely important. So that's the kind of international collective action that we have to try to generate. We have to build this together. We have to build it by being cooperative, and build it by using economic structures which give people, like trade, which give people an incentive to come together as opposed to cheat. But above all, at the end of the day, it's going to be the pressure from the individuals and the electorates in countries that are the ultimate sanction. There's not going to be a global body that's going to develop an accepted baseball bat that comes and beats people over the head when they transgress. I don't think many of us would want it, and I don't think many of us believe that that would come about. The ultimate sanction is building the kinds of institutions and structures which pull people together. That's the incentive story. The sanction is the electorates of countries that are going to demand it. They're demanding it in many parts of the world. In the UK now, the three major parties are competing on this issue and challenging the others for not going fast enough. There's an election now. It's election year in Canada. It's an election year in Australia. I've spoken in both countries in the last 6 weeks. And it's amazing how the election has focused people's minds on those issues. Why? Because those who are fighting for political power recognise that this is a basic element of the political competition process. It's what people want. So that is a very important part of the story as well. So this is the kind of way in which you can build international collective action, and that's a challenge that we have to face up to. This is a picture of how global carbon markets could work. The yellow at the bottom is the trade, is the emissions subject to trade in Europe, and you could, it's about nearly half actually, around half of European emissions are subject to cap and trade. You can extend that margin, you could, for example, and we should bring in airlines into that story, and you can extend it across the countries. There's enormous scope for increasing these world carbon markets, and I do think that along with taxation, that will be a very important part of the story. I think we'll use taxation in some areas, like gasoline, we'll use cap and trade in other areas, and we're going to need both of them, and they should be working in harmony, one with the other. But this is the trade story that I'm illustrating here. The demand side will come from major reduction ambitions in the rich countries. That means the 60 to 90% reductions by 2050 that I was talking about. A lot of the supply side will come from the developing countries, and we need to develop much better benchmarks in the current system. A word or two about deforestation. Now, deforestation is a very important part of this story. This diagram tells us two things. One is that emissions come from right across the economy. And electricity and transport, important though they are, and less than half of the global emissions. You've got emissions from buildings, you've got emissions from industry, and you've got emissions from land use. Mostly that's deforestation. Some of it is peat fires, but it's deforestation and peat fires. And then you've got agriculture itself. You disturb. When you get involved in agriculture, you might use fertilizers, you disturb the soil, that releases carbon. So there are all these other sources of emissions as well. So you have to act right across the board. There's no one sector that you can't just concentrate on electricity, you can't just concentrate on transport. You've got to look right across the board if you're going to get these kinds of emissions reductions. Deforestation is currently a larger source of emissions than transport, all of transport. I was in Indonesia just 2 weeks ago, and they just discovered that they're the third largest emitter after the United States and China. Why? Because of deforestation and peat fires. They're also a country of 17,000 islands located around the equator, very vulnerable to the effects of climate change. They're taking this very seriously, and they're hosting the Bali conference at the end of this year, the next meeting of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. I believe that is a real opportunity to move strongly forwards. But deforestation is a very big issue, and I think that for an expenditure of something like $10 billion a year, we could reduce the emissions from deforestation by about 2 gigatons. That would give you a cost of carbon for doing that, around $5 a ton, much cheaper than anything else except, of course, energy efficiency. So deforestation, stopping deforestation, is a very big challenge, and I believe that initially we should work out how to do it efficiently, and then we should bring it in to the world trading schemes. I've not said much about adaptation. I'm more than happy to respond in questions, but it is a very big issue. I've emphasised that what we're seeing now, at least I should have said, what we're seeing now in the world at the moment are the effects of a 0.7 degree centigrade increase. We've got another 1.5 or 2 degrees centigrade on the way, even if we act strongly and responsibly now. We have to adapt. And of course, another 1.5 is going to be a lot more than twice the 0.7 that we've seen already, because these effects are highly convex. You know, they're much more than double if you double the amount of temperature increase. There's a lot of adaptation that we have to deal with. London sewers won't be able to cope with the wetter winters and that we're going to see. London Underground is extremely difficult to air condition. We'll have to air condition it somehow, but it's going to be quite expensive to do. The Thames Barrage doesn't is being used much more, that's to stop the storm surges up the Thames, is much more used much more frequently than it was. We're probably going to have to invest in strengthening that. Now, those are just three examples of major changes in a town which I have, with which I have some strong affinity, as any of you would have been able to tell by my accent. But what we have to do in London is small relative to the kinds of problems that developing countries are going to face. So the case for extra aid, which many of us thought was pretty overwhelming anyway, I think becomes absolutely compelling if you think about the problems of adaptation to climate change. We did actually think that the 0.7% of GDP in aid target should be increased, but having, you know, with Jeff and Joe and others spent a lot of blood, sweat and tears over the last 30 years trying to get decent promises, and we did get decent promises in the last few years on increasing aid, we decided in this case just to say, well, you better deliver on the promises that you've made rather than upping the ante. But there is actually a case for upping the ante. We didn't go that route because we thought we'd just be opening another can of worms, but in logic there is an argument there. So the research questions on the policy front I've really described as I go, working out the kinds of ways to make these markets work better internationally is a very important research challenge. There's lots of important detail involved there. I emphasise carbon capture and storage, particularly for coal, as a key technological challenge, and the whole adaptation story has to be investigated in much more detail. So there we are, that's the storyline. The case for strong and urgent action is, in my view, overwhelming. I believe that if we do act strongly and quickly, that the kinds of costs involved would be acceptable. 1% increase in costs would be of great economic value relative to the kinds of damages that will be avoided. It's the kind of story that can be combined with growth and with energy security. It has to be international, and we have to learn and much better how to work together internationally. This is the most international problem of all the problems that you could think of. It puts international collaboration at an absolute premium. And what we can't do is wave fingers at each other and say, I'm not going to do anything until everybody else does everything, because then everybody will do nothing. And that's not the way forward. I've tried to describe the ways in which we can build international action. And I have emphasised that come what may, there's a lot of change along the way, and we're going to have to adapt to it. Thank you very much.
And that was Nicholas Stern, a former chief economist of the World Bank and lead author of the Stern Review, published last fall by the British government, an extensive review of the economics of global climate change. And if you want to find it on the web, search for Stern Review, it'll show up. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. We will be returning to this topic next week with some of the contributors to the nation's special issue on climate change. Let's go out with more from the Partita No. 6 for keyboard by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Glenn Gould. Till next week, bye.